to Nate for saving like 10 minutes off my talk. And so maybe I'll manage to say everything I want to say, or maybe not. So maybe I'll start giving you a definition. And the definition due to Andrew Toms and Wilhelm Winter, the strongly self-absorbing C-star algebra. In the paper of Toms and Winter and the transactions. And let's suppose that D, so we have D is a separable unital C-star algebra. Okay, well, I mean, I'm sure he knows this. He's not missing much. So we're separable, and typically, like, you know, let's assume infinite dimensional, or at least, well, I mean, there's always debate of whether zero is unital or not. Let's not get into that. So let's say infinite dimensional. Okay, but that's just to rule out the complex numbers and zero if you think it's unital to avoid those trivialities. Such a C-star algebra is called strongly self-absorbing. If self-absorbing would mean that D is isomorphic to D tensor D, and but we require a stronger condition, we require furthermore that the first coordinate map, the map D maps into D tensor 1, or second coordinate map, doesn't matter, whichever you prefer, this is approximately unitarily equivalent to an isomorphism. Bunch of unitaries conjugating that to an isomorphism. So it somehow absorbs itself in this very strong sense. Now, I should say, of course, when I write tensor, I should say what I mean. It actually doesn't matter what I mean. You can pick your favorite tensor product. If those conditions hold, then it follows that the algebra has to be nuclear. So you may as well take the minimal one in the definition, but it doesn't matter for that. This condition is pretty restrictive, and if you look at what are the known algebras, there aren't that many of them. So here's a full list of the known examples. One example which is easy to prove, that's an easy exercise, you just take what's called UHF algebras of infinite type. This simply means that, you have a UHF algebra, it means that it has a supernatural number associated to it, and you look at each prime, so if the prime is there, it has to be there with infinite multiplicity, and that's obviously needed there. So for the definition, it's a very easy exercise to see that's true. The second one, another example is the Zhang II algebra, which Nate told you about, so I don't have to tell you about it again, you all know what it is. And that satisfies those properties too. We'll count that as a definition. It's better than a definition I wanted to give. So. Right there. Right there. Okay. And you can also take you can take O2 and O infinity, and you can also take you can tensor those, right? And take O infinity. Of course, you can take any two in the class and tensor them to get another one, so you can take O infinity and tensor it by one of these, right? Of course, you can also take O infinity and tensor it by this, but that won't do anything because O infinity already absorbs that. So actually, and ditto for, right, so O2 absorbs everything, we know that. That's Kepler's theorem. So basically, these are the known examples. Of course, this is easy to prove, that's an exercise, this is a pretty hard theorem, but those are all known cases. I put a line here because this separates the two. These are stably finite, those are purely infinite. So those are known examples, and It's a list of known examples. I mean, there's some, if you're inclined to believe the ELS program, these are all of them. So it's not that there are no, we don't know of any more examples because we're stupid. It's because, you know, if there is another example, it would be a pretty nasty counterexample of the ELS program. It won't be a kind of those weird examples which Michael Rudam and Andrew Toms constructed. It would be a very odd thing. It really shouldn't exist. I mean, something could be wrong with the universe if there was something else. But, you know, we don't know yet, so maybe there's another one, right? Now maybe I should say that all those algebras share a feature which I didn't put in the definition. If you look at the unitary group of those algebras, it's connected, right? The unitary group of those examples is connected. Now we don't know how to prove that from the general fact. You can, if you have an extra assumption, let's say if the algebra is this happens to be true, and sometimes you need to use some weaker condition here. Actually, what you need is to if you take a commutator of two unitaries, we often will need that to be in the connected component. So, but in any event, this is a feature which happens automatically in all cases. So sometimes they'll throw that in as, well, in some theorems they'll say there's an extra technical assumption which holds in all known examples. It's some weaker version of this, but this is all anyway true as far as we know. Okay? So I'll just mention that. Good. So, of course, this is a pretty short list of examples, so you kind of wonder why bother studying it. I mean, we know what the examples are, they've been studied, I mean, you know, why, right? But the reason those examples are, I mean, what's really make them interesting is not so much the examples themselves, even though they're all interesting, but rather the fact as what Nate talked about, I mean, looking at absorption of those algebras is interesting, right? What's interesting is studying, so say, let's say A is D absorbing or D stable? A is isomorphic to A tensor D. And of course, since the D is isomorphic to D tensor D, if you take A tensored by D, then it's D absorbing for that particular D. So Nate talked about Z absorption. Those things have been looked at for, with all of those examples, essentially, have been looked at for, and all of it important. I mean, absorption of UHF algebras has been studied originally by Michael Rudam, and you could prove that if you take an algebra and tensor it by, let's say, the Carre algebra, then suddenly it has lots of nice properties. That was kind of generalized to approximate divisibility, which somehow, maybe I'll say something about it, somehow it's not an algebra, it's a property which is some way resembles these things, and then it's been shown that Z absorption is better. Of course, for O infinity and O2, absorbing them is kind of an essential part of the Kirchberg-Phillips work. Kirchberg absorption theorems are really the heart of it. So deabsorption, the property of looking when A absorbs one of these, is an important question. Where many examples do that naturally. Okay, so once you have a property, the natural thing is what I want to talk about now, what I've been working on in the past couple of years, is the question of, well, I mean, you take a property, you take an algebra which has a property, you do something nasty to the algebra, you look at the algebra again, and you wonder, well, does that still have the property, right? That's what you're starting to see how robust the property actually is. And in the original paper of Toms and Winter, they proved that, so that's what we call permanence property. And what they showed was that, that again is the Toms and Winter paper. They showed that deabsorption passes to, looking at hereditary subalgebras. And for some of those things, you need to have the extra technical assumption. Okay, so I'm not going to say that over and over again, but typically when you state something, I'm assuming that beyond the definition, we have some assumption. The assumption really that you need, I mean, they stated K1 inductivity, the assumption you really need is to have the commutator of any two unitaries, you want that to be in the connected component. Okay, but that holds for this obvious reason, all the known examples, So that's a technical theorem. I'm going to assume that's a blanket assumption from now on. So you won't have to say it over and over again, even though I probably will. Okay, so it passes through hereditary sub algebras, in particular through ideals. It passes through quotients. It passes through inductive limits. And it passes through extensions. Probably I should have apologized in the beginning of the talk. Some of you have heard me talking about some of those things in various cases, but I'm not sure if any of you have probably there would be something new for everybody. And anyway, whoever heard me talk about those things probably forgot about it. So I have the chance to bore you again. So if you form an extension of one deabsorbing algebra by another, then the extension also has this property. Okay, but now since we're in dynamics conference, I guess the obvious question would be, well, what about cross products? Okay, so we have a Caesar algebra, we have some group acting on the Caesar algebra, we have automorphisms, we form the cross products. Well, if this original algebra was deabsorbing, would the new one be deabsorbing or not? Well, the answer is not. So the answer is no, and that's known. I mean, there are k-theoretic problems here. I mean, it's known that if you can read it, there's a very nice example in the paper of Izumi. Although I think there are previous examples of due to Blackadder. You can find examples of finite group actions, let's say Z2, Z mod 2, acting on O2, such as the cross product, it has non-trivial K theory. Okay, there's examples. So, for example, there exists an action of Z2 on O2, such that O2, the cross product with Z2 is Z mod 2, not two added numbers. Such as this cross product has non-trivial K theory. Now, of course, if you take any Caesar algebra and tensor it by O2, you'd get an algebra with trivial K theory, and O2 is O2 absorbing, but the cross product would not be O2 absorbing. And of course, and you can also show basically using, solves from this fact. That we can consider this to be an action, a periodic action of the integers, and that cross product would not be the O2 absorbing as well. It would have trivial K theory, but it would have a quotient which is not O2 absorbing. Okay, so it doesn't mean we should give up. It does mean that the question should be, well, are there any decent properties? Can we understand what kind of automorphisms would satisfy those permanence? I mean, are there any reasonable properties we can ask for? We want a property which, on the one hand, would be useful. We could use it to get absorption. On the other hand, some property which appears, which you can verify in some reasonable way. And the good property for this purpose is what's called the Rochel property. In various guidelines. So there's I'll give you the definition in case you haven't thought about it. For a finite group, let's say, let's put A as unital to make our life easier. The definition, again, there are some works of Izumi on that. We say that a Caesar, an action, the alpha is A unital, has a Rochel property if you can find central sequence of partitions of unity into projections which are essentially permuted by the group action. or so. We can write it using central sequence formalism, or we can write like this. We can, let's say that there are, let's say for any finite set here, the finite and epsilon, you can find a bunch of projections. Okay, those are projections. They are partition of one. And, they almost commute with all the elements of the finite set, okay, for any f in f, g, and g. And they get almost commuted by the group action. So if we take alpha h applied to eg, that would be approximately e of h. Okay, so if you have this kind of condition, and it happens sometimes, then the cross product would have to be permanence would go through. So we have a Rochlin action of a finite group. Then we'll follow through. Maybe I won't give you the proof. Even the proof is basically two lines. This is very easy. Of course, I'll talk in a moment about the integers and the reals. But I should just say that this, even though it's Rochlin property, it does have, for finite group actions, it has very good properties. It's very rare. It's not something we should just see typically. It's a very non-standard. Just to see what's going on, let's suppose that we had, let's suppose G is just Z mod 2. And then what we're saying here is it's going to split one into two projections which are equivalent by an automorphism. And so if you think about, let's say, O infinity, you think for a second, you can't write one as a sum of two projections which are equivalent by an automorphism. These have to be equivalent, period. And that can't happen. So there are no actions of any finite group or on O infinity which have the Rochlin property. Okay, so it's not a very common property, but it does occur sometimes. But it would be interesting to find other properties, and I'll talk about that if I have time later. Now, we can also prove really the original property, I think, was for the integer actions, not for the finite groups. For Z, what the Rochlin property would mean is that you do something similar, only you don't take it the whole way. It's not that you take infinitely many projections. That would make no sense at all because you can't take infinite sums. What you do is you take some sort of tower. You take a bunch of projections, and you'd only want this to be permuted up to a point, right? So what we'd say is that, maybe I'll just to draw it, we'd have a partition of unity into a bunch of projections. Okay, you can take a bunch of towers. Actually, you could just do two towers, but I'll just draw three. So what the property would say, and maybe I'll say it rather than write it, is that, well, for any finite set and for any height, okay, let's call it height. Let's say height h. Okay? I made the height lower than towers. I can find a bunch of, each one of those is a projection. Okay? I'm just drawing it. Think of these as a projection. I'm not going to give it various funny indices. Those are a bunch of projections, just diagrammatically. I can find a bunch of projections, right? And, I'm drawing them in a bunch of stacks. Each stack is at least of this height, such that we have the same commutation relations. If we take any of these projections, any element in my given reference finite set, they commute up to epsilon. And what my action does, they have a single automorphism. What our automorphism does, it pushes them up, right? It takes this one to this one, right? And so on. Okay, it pushes each one of them to the one which sits above it. Well, what is it to this? We don't know. So it pushes all the way up, and this goes somewhere down, right? I mean, this would somehow be smeared among the base, but that would just follow from the definition. So we can push it up until the top, and the top it's on its own. Okay? So that's the Rochlin property for Z. And you can also come up with an analog for R. Okay, so I'm not sure if this picture is clear or not. I hope it is. For R, you can do a similar thing, where here, of course, instead of, better be continuous, right? So So what we want to do is somehow take some sort of line. Well, what the hell does that mean? Well, so this would mean that we take some sort of continuously smeared projections, if you will. We think of these being kind of spectral projections in some sort. So we'd have something which gets pushed up and goes down. So really what you have is kind of a copy of a circle. So we'd have a unitary which gets turned around. So we'd have copies of, here we'd have a bunch of projections. Here the correct analog would be C of T, where you identify C of T with C of R modulo some big number times Z, right? Okay, so you take some height, you take some line of length, you know, a million, mod out by that. You connect it to the bottom, that's kind of an analog of this, and it gets acted on by the real, so you just, you know, shift it around. Okay, and these things exist. Okay, so I won't write the formal definitions. I hope this picture will give you some idea of what's going on. And you can prove that if you have the Rochman property, so the theorem that's in the paper by myself and Winter, so that shows that if A is D-absorbing and G is finite, or actually we could do actually compact, and you can generalize this to compact groups. Z or R, and the action has, we have an action with the respective Rochman property, then A, the cross product, is deabsorbing. Okay, now just to, if you haven't thought about the Rochman property, I mean, as I said, for finite groups it's not very common. For the integers, it's actually fairly common. You do see it a lot. There are some cases where it's even generic. And the example you might want to have in mind is, let's say the shift takes, you know, in an infinite tensor product of matrix algebras, the shift has a Rochman property. So it's kind of a very natural example to have it. Okay. So, okay, so maybe I'll say something about the proof a bit later. I think it would be with a lower priority. So if I have time at the end, when do I end? 11? Or before that? Or? Oh, a little bit later. Okay. So we have half an hour? A bit more. Okay, so maybe I'll go back in the end and give you, tell you something about the proof when you're all asleep and won't catch any mistakes. So nonetheless, I mean, as I said, even though the Rochman property is great, I mean, you do encounter it a lot. There are some natural examples which don't have the Rochman property, certainly for finite groups. For finite groups, it's pretty rare. So we definitely would want to find other, I mean, we know we can't do it in general because we have the counter example. But it would be nice to find some other properties or other reasonable conditions which would guarantee that we have permanence. By the way, I should say that we don't, I mean, I know for finite group actions, you can show that, well, O2 permanence doesn't work. We have a counterexample. O infinity permanence does work. That's a general fact. If you form the cross product, it would always be O infinity absorbing. I should qualify that. If you have a finite group action on O infinity, right? If instead of O2 you write O infinity and you have a finite group acting on O infinity, doesn't matter how it acts, the cross product would have to be O infinity absorbing just because it would be a finite direct sum of purely infinite simple nuclear structures. Now you could get counterexamples for UHF algebras. So at least for O infinity acting that, you know, for example, you know, you might get something which says the cross product, an O infinity tensor, let's say M3 to the infinity equals O2 tensor M3 to the infinity equals O2, and you can show that thing, for example, would not absorb the 3 to the infinity UHF algebra. For instance, you can get those kind of examples. So you can get counterexamples for UHF algebras. I don't know if you can get counterexamples for Z. And for the Jang 2 algebra, I mean, it seems like on the one hand, you might think, well, it behaves more like UHF algebra, you ought to have a counterexample. On the other hand, maybe it behaves more like O infinity. In the same case theory, maybe it kind of has this kind of role, in which case maybe there are no counterexample. So you kind of change your mind every day. And so maybe I'll say the question: is there a group action let's say of G of any group, right? Of some group. On the Jang 2 algebra, such as this cross product is not okay. And I don't know, but presumably if you have some weird group, if you pick some non-amenable group, maybe something would happen. But let's say a finite group, or Z, or the integers, or something. Seems like a natural example, and I don't know. And actually, you know, if the answer happens to be no for reasonable groups, let's say if the answer is no for Z, then that would be very interesting. It seems unlikely. I think the answer should be that there is one. But okay. Right. But so as I said, even if you look at certainly for finite groups, it's also for the integers or the reals. I mean, there are many examples which don't have the Grossmann property. Take, for instance, just the Jang 2 algebra. It's what Nate did not mention is it's projectionless. I mean, it's obvious from what he said, but it has no projections. So obviously, and the Grossmann property asks for a lot of projections, right? You need to have those big towers with tons of projections. So obviously, no action on the Grossmann property for trivial reasons can possibly have the Grossmann property. And there are many other examples which don't have it. Of course, for finite group actions, as I said, it's very restrictive. There are many natural examples which don't have it. Maybe I'd change the order of what I want to say and talk a bit about some other examples I've been looking at recently, and then I'll mention something which goes into the proof and some other results of myself and Winter. So one natural example, which seems natural to me, is this. Here's just an obvious example. Well, you know, D is isomorphic to D tensor D. Well, so we have an obvious automorphism there, right? We take D tensor D and flip the order. Right? Well, is the cross product deabsorbing? I mean, well, what can you say about that cross product? It seems like a very natural thing to look at. And more generally, we could say the following thing. Let's suppose that we have... here's an example. Example of group action. So let's suppose that we have some group. Let's say G is a group. Let's suppose G acts on some set. Let's say on S set. Okay. So of course we can form a tensor product, right? So we can form a tensor product. Let's put, you know, okay, let's say dx or x and s. Okay, form a cross product, a tensor product of, you know, just put a copy of d over every point in the set, and this induces an action on that, right? We can just, you know, if g permutes somehow the elements of the set, then of course permutes the tensor factors. So we have an automorphism group of that. Okay? So this is, of course, isomorphic to D. And G has an induced action on D, right? Okay, we just take A1 tensor A2 and whatever and permute them according to what the group tells us. So this kind of is an obvious generalization of what I said there, and what can we say about this case? I mean, that seems natural enough. Of course, this includes things. I mean, you know, I can't say anything about in this generality. I can say something which is if G is a finite group, or some other groups. But you know, kind of one example which I'd like to talk to understand, and I don't understand yet, is the shift. Right, the shift is an example. Take G and S to be the integers. And look at the shift. I mean, and so we know that shift in all cases except for the Jang 2 algebra has the Rochen property, so there's no problem. It's covered by the previous theorem. But for the Jang 2 algebra, it doesn't have the Rochen property. So we can't use that result, but obviously, you know, it should be true, but I don't know how to prove it. Okay, but we could prove it for all the known examples. Theorem, let me, I'll talk a bit about the proof of this if I have time. Again, this is some other paper in preparation. Hope it should be done soon by myself and Wilhelm. Which says if D is, well, here we don't have a technical assumption. Here we said we actually look at every single one of those examples. If D is any of those known examples, and let's say S is, or G is finite, okay? Then this cross product is the absorbing. And you can generalize that easy way to infinite groups which act in kind of a finite way. So for example, to S infinity, to the infinite symmetric group. You know, the group of all permutations of the natural numbers, such as each one of them just moves finitely many elements. You can easily get that too, for example. Okay. So maybe I'll say a few words about how we might prove that, and then because it uses, at least for the Jang 2 algebra, it uses some other paper, which is more interesting, and I'll talk a bit about that paper, and that would be largely it. So first of all, I should say that if we want to go through the examples, well, of course, O infinity tensor UHF, you know, we may be able to verify it for O infinity, verify it for the separator. So we just need to verify it for this, and this. Now, for this, I actually told you it's always true, regardless of what group action you take, so that's done. Here you have the Rochen property that's in the Izumi's paper, so that's done. So that's not our proof. Shouldn't take credit for that. So it's actually really the question is about what happens in these cases. In these cases, you don't have the Rochen property. Well, here for obvious reasons, here for less obvious reasons, but you don't have it. So the question is, what do we do? Okay, so maybe I'll erase the definition and give you some outline of how this might work out. Actually, I should say, well, I think it's interesting, but really the motivation for doing that was to try to get some insight into the shift. And so far, I have not gotten into the shift on the Jang 2 algebra. So far, I have not gotten insight into the Jang 2 shift. I mean, this didn't help, but I thought, well, that's interesting anyway. Right, so let's just for outline the proof, let's just do it for simplicity for the flip. Okay, when we take D tensor D and flip it. Okay, so here's the outline of proof for the flip. Okay, on D tensor D. Okay, we just flip the two factors. And now, it follows from this kind of a central sequence characterization Nate mentioned that it's actually good enough in this context to try to embed D into the fixed points of algebra. Okay, and even enough to do it approximately. I've almost embedded. So the first step, well, it's enough. That's an easy step. To embed D into the fixed points of algebra. Let's say D, I'll write D2 here, but it's true in general, right? Okay, so the fixed points of algebra. Okay. Right. So, okay, and if you have, you know, if you have the, let's say, an infinite tensor product with 2x2 matrices, then of course it's enough to do it for each matrix separately. So we just need to embed, you know, n by n matrices into, so for instance, you might want to embed, you know, n by n matrices into this, right? For example. Well, okay, so you just need to, well, this you can understand, right? You know what this is, right? So what's a fixed point algebra? Well, you can compute it. It's, you know, it's a, you know, it's a finite dimensional algebra. How hard could it be? And it's not hard. You can actually do some little computation. It's a very easy computation. Well, let's see. Let's do the computation, more or less. Well, I mean, you know, this flip is just, it's, you know, it's a finite, it's a matrix algebra. You know, any automorphism is given by unitary. So we just need to pick the unitary which does that and look at its commutant. Right, so this is just the commutant of this unitary. Okay, and then you just need to compute, so we need to see what the eigenvalues are. And, you know, and then, you know, through each one of them we'd have a matrix block. Right, and then you just compute the eigenvalues to see that you have, you do a little combinatorial computation, pretty easy one. And you see that you have, that this is decomposed in 2 bits. You have 2 eigenvalues, it's flipped, of course, so, you know, 1 minus 1 or lambda minus lambda. And they would have multiplicities n times n plus 1 over 2 and n times n minus 1 over 2. Okay, and so now to consider prime n. So, of course, if n is prime and not 2, then we can embed, you know, then n divides this and n divides this, and we're fine. If n equals 2, it doesn't really work because, you know, for us, if n equals 2, then this we just get like, you know, M3 plus M1 plus the complex numbers, right? And of course M2 does not embed into this unitary. The embedding has to be unital. Okay, so that doesn't quite work out. But then you think about it for a bit more and say, well, okay, we don't need to embed M2 into the fixed points of algebra of M2 tensor M2. We can do it into the fixed points of algebra of M2 tensor M2, tensor M2, tensor M2. So M4 tensor M4. Now you plug in 4, you get 6 and 10, and that's fine, because both are even. So you do this little trick and it works. Now for other groups, you know, we just reduce it to looking at, you know, you want to embed it, if we have n factors and we have some group acting on it, well, we may as well embed it into the fixed points of algebra of the whole symmetric group. Right, I mean, we may as well do that. And then you just do a little computation with some basic facts about representation theory. I mean, you know, what we need to do is, what we're doing here essentially is counting the dimensions of the irreducible representations of that. So here we just have, you know, this is the trivial representation, this is the non-trivial representation of V2. And for finite symmetric groups, there is a general, some general basic facts we could use to get information about the dimensions. So that's not complicated stuff, and we get that result. Okay. Let's up there. Now, for the Jang 2 algebra, you can do it in a more elaborate way. There are a few ways to do it. First, they had an ugly way to do it, and then I realized there was a kind of slicker way to do it using some other results, which I'll talk about. So for the Jang 2 algebra, I won't talk to you about the ugly version, because who wants to hear about it? Let's talk about the nicer version. So as Nate said, we call it D23. Apparently, D23. Okay, so we have D23. So that we said is, to remind you, we take functions from here into, okay, of course I'm doing it here for, yeah, okay, that's fine. 2 to the infinity, 3 to the infinity, such that, tensor, sorry, take this. Such that f of 0 is in the first factor, f of 1 is in the second factor. Okay, so think about it. This is something which kind of fits over, right? You know, it's kind of a continuous field of algebras over the interval over each point. You know, here we have 2 to the UHF algebra 2 to the infinity. Here we have 3 to the infinity. Here we have 6 to the infinity in the middle. Okay, so we kind of vary the sit over this interval. So if you look at the tensor product by itself, as you would guess, you'd get something over the square. Okay, so if this is D23, of course, so we want to embed Z into Z tensor Z fixed points. So that was about, we may as well use this one, because what they didn't tell you is that we can actually embed Z into this one. So, and this is subalgebra of Z, so it's good enough. Okay, so we can do this. So that's actually false from this one. Okay, so we have this basically, right? So this is the D23 tensor D23. Okay, this is kind of a continuous field of algebras over the square with some obvious boundary conditions, right? Okay, you can easily think about what they ought to be. Okay, and then what we're doing is we're folding it in half, right? We're flipping it. So we're kind of folding it in half. Okay, and of course, like, you know, when we fold it, we have some problems with the fold. I mean, the fold, if we have here, at this point here, we'd have M2 to the infinity tensor, M3 to the infinity squared, right? And now we're flipping these, so it'll write like this. Tensor, same thing. Right, we're flipping these. So this is the kind of thing we'd see in this point when we fold, right? Okay? Now, what turns out, you can embed Z into these inputs. So you know, by what we said there, essentially, we can embed either one of those into the problematic points, right? So we can embed a UHF algebra into each point. Here we just have, you know, this is the same as this. So here we just have M6 to the infinity. There's no problem. So to each point, we can embed a UHF algebra. And since any UHF algebra absorbs the Jang 2 algebra, we can embed the Jang 2 algebra into every single point of the fixed point of this continuous field, folded in half. Okay, where the kind of problematic aspect is to do it on the boundary, on the fold, and that follows from what's written there. Okay, and then we have the following question. Well, let's suppose we have a continuous field of Fischer algebras, and we know that over each point we can embed Z. Okay, each point is Z absorbing. Here, each point is some sort of a UHF algebra. It's Z absorbing. It's not a UHF algebra inserted in the slip, but it is actually. But it's a AF algebra, but that doesn't matter. Let's suppose that each point is Z absorbing. Is it true that the whole algebra is Z absorbing? So let's write this question. Okay, so maybe I'll just write in what it said here. So here we have So this fixed point algebra, so D23, tensor D23, D2, this is kind of a continuous field of Fischer algebras over this folded interval, a folded square. Right, with some funny boundary conditions, doesn't really matter, but we can absorb Z into each fiber. Okay, so here we just appeal to a result from a different paper, So here we have a general theorem. So just to remind you, there's a generalization, of course, of the notion of a continuous field. It's a better definition, a phi of x algebra, where you don't assume continuity necessarily, only upper semi-continuity. So just to remind you the definition. Let's say A is unital for simplicity. We don't need that. A is unital. Well, Fischer algebra. So it is along with the unital homomorphism from C of X into the center of A, this is called C of X algebra. Okay, you can kind of think of it as a continuous field, or not quite continuous, but some sort of field of Fischer algebras over X. Okay, this is called okay, so here we have an example where X is this kind of triangle. we'll create this triangle embedded into the center. Functions over the triangle embedded into the center. And that gives you the structure of a field. Okay, and, right? So well, once we have that, then we have a notion of what does it mean to be a fiber. And there's a theorem from another paper, so the theorem in Mathematica Nalan of joint with Michael Rodam and Wilhelm Winter, which says that, well, if X is finite, it has finite covering dimension, so if A is, well, I'm not writing all the conditions again, separable, unital, that's all we need actually, so I can write them, but I won't. A is separable, unital, C of X algebra, we don't need unital either, actually, separable. We won't write it anyway. C of X algebra, X has finite covering dimension, and each fiber is deabsorbing, then A is deabsorbing. Okay, certainly we could use that result here, because, you know, the triangle is finite dimensional. And of course, more generally, what we'd have is this kind of symmetric space. We'd have this, you know, n cube modulo the action of the symmetric group by permutation. That's certainly a finite dimensional space. So this result is applicable. I should say it's, you know, of course, in line with Nate's talk, if the dimension is infinite, it doesn't work. There are counterexamples for most. Okay, so this doesn't work. Okay, not that the proof doesn't work. It doesn't work in their counterexamples. For most cases, if x equals infinity, I should say again, there are actually counterexamples to all the known examples of strongly self-absorbing algebras, except for O infinity, where we don't know what happens. Okay. Right. So this takes care of that. I have how many minutes? Five. Okay. So well, I was going to say something about the proof of that theorem, but maybe I won't. It's better to finish a bit early. But instead I want to, because there are some questions I've been bugging people here with during coffee breaks, and maybe since you're all in the room, I can bug all of you in a more efficient way. So I mean, of course, there are, you know, the question is how to generalize this. Where, as I said, you know, the kind of the main motivating question was to try to get it for the ship, right? And that I still do not do. There is some progress there, but still suck largely. I mean, there's some, not quite clear how to get it to work. I'm optimistic, but another question which I think is more appropriate for this crowd is to say, well, could we do it? Could we make sense of it? Not can we do it? Can we even make sense of the question before we could do it for continuous groups, for non-discrete groups? What do I mean by that? Well, let's suppose we have a, so it's a very vague question. Very vague question. The kind of the most annoying kind of question. But the question for, before we even try to prove in theorems, can we even make sense of it? And I think it would be an interesting thing to look at. I mean, if we take, you know, let's say G mod N, I'll draw it like this, right? Let's say, for example. Of course, we put a point over each one of the copy of this D over each one of these guys, right? And or if you want, you can maybe it's better to say that over every finite set we have a copy of D, just D tensor, D tensor, D tensor, complex numbers, complex numbers, complex numbers, right? Okay. So each set you take here, right? You have a certain copy. You have a copy of D, right? D tensor, D tensor, D, and put complex numbers on the ones which are not circled, right? Kind of a complicated way of saying it, and we're just you know, and if we have this finite group, it just shifts it to one, right? Now, of course, so the question could make sense of it over, let's say, the circle, for example. What would that mean? Well, we'd want presumably to have a situation where over every, let's say, open set, for every interval, we'd have a copy associated to it. So we'd have D, we can think about, this is kind of like a tensor product decomposition of D, right? Where D is D tensor, D tensor, D around, right? So I'd like to see if we could we do, could we make sense of a continuous tensor product decomposition of one of those Ds? Could we, you know, so maybe I'd like to have, so I'd have D, right? And let's say to every open set, let's say inside, I'll write a circle, but, or, you know, but you could put any set you want here, right? Any non-discrete set. So we don't want to have some sub-algebra, let's say D, O, in D, which they would satisfy some obvious axioms. For example, if O1 intersect O2 is empty, then we'd like those to commute, right? All right, they would commute, sorry, not, it would commute D of O1 in general union D of O2, the algebra they generate would just be the algebra of the union, and the intersection would be just the algebra associated with the intersection. Each one of those could be just isomorphic, right? D would be isomorphic to D itself. Well, if the set is not empty, of course. If the set is empty, we should have the complex numbers. And, of course, D of the whole thing should be the whole thing. Well, is this possible? I've been playing around with it. I mean, it's kind of the first thing you'd think about to say, well, it kind of resembles the car relations, right? Not exactly. You look at the car algebra, you can look at the car algebra of L2 of the circle and try to do that. But then it doesn't really work because, you know, of course, if you take have disjoint sets, the car algebra of this of the projection of this subspace and some other subspace won't commute. They would commute up to grading. So then say, oh well, I know what we'll do. I'll take the even car algebra. That would work. But then this doesn't work. So the question, but it seems like, you know, maybe it's possible to tweak it somehow and get it to work. An associated question or related question, and this is all very vague stuff, and maybe it makes absolutely no sense, and maybe there's some obvious reason someone can jump up and say, well, you know, this makes no sense, it can't possibly happen. But some of the car algebra picture is very, very similar, it's almost there, so it seems promising in a way to me, I don't know. Maybe a similar question would be, well, can we come up with some reasonable, easier semigroup-like objects here? What do we mean by that? And we'll finish by this. If we have an easier semigroup, right, this goes from V of H to itself. Now, V of H, of course, is not a strongly self-adjoint tensor algebra, but, of course, if you form the proper, like, the Feloyman algebra tensor product, then the flip is, it does actually work in a sense. We just need to take a different tensor product. It's a big change, of course, but, you know, nonetheless, there is some artificial resemblance. And, you know, so if you have an easier semigroup, then what do we know? Well, we look at alpha T of V of H. Right, we can look at the commutant. Well, this is also isomorphic to B of H, right? Right, and B of H is a tensor product of the range and the commutant. Right? So could we do something similar with one of these? Instead of B of H, could we have an easier semigroup which behaves in this way? A semigroup endomorphism, which has this property, which is the range, well, these are simple Fischer algebras. The range will be isomorphic to D. Could we get the commutant to be isomorphic to D as well, such as they would generate? Would they behave like an E0 semigroup? Could we do that? Let's see, with the car algebra, with O2 or O infinity, right? So could we have something like, let's say, like the car flow, which has this behavior? The car flow doesn't because we have this grading. But could we get rid of the grading somehow in some clever way? I don't know. So maybe that's everything I wanted to say, and I'll stop. Yeah, that's basically the question. Can you do conformal field theory with not with Feloyman algebras, but with Fischer algebras, which have this very strong property? Just the car algebra, for example, or O infinity. Could you have conformal field theory based on O infinity? Let's say.
Yes, but so you have to select a good dense Fischer algebra. Isn't it? So what's the other problem that you need? Because
what's the
so here, all these axioms that you have written here.
Right.
What else do you need?
Well, actually, to be honest, I'm not completely sure. But let's say, can you just start with this?
I think.
Well, pretty what I don't want to do is, of course, have a homogeneity because I want to generate the group action. So if I have, what I should have added is that if I have here the circle acting, so of course if the circle moves it to this, I'd like that to induce an automorphism, which does that, right? Well, that's great. But,
I don't know that it probably doesn't exist because everybody would love to find this, you know, and for at least 50 years, everybody would love to have found one of these things.
Well, okay, I mean, so maybe it's not a good question, or it is a good question, I'm not sure. In some sense, it is.